Welcome to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart. Coming up on this episode.
If your motivation for justice is bitterness, even if you get that which is right, it can taste like poison to everybody else. So if our motivation for justice in this world is because we're bitter and angry, even when we get justice, we're left with bitterness and anger. But if what drives our quest for justice in this world is love and compassion, when you get justice, you're left with love and compassion.
Why are we here? Can I have a relationship with God? These kinds of things I can't measure with my microscope or my telescope.
Hope deranges us. Hope breaks things and breaks things down.
Christianity isn't some kind of self-help doctrine. It's not probiotics for the soul or something, you know?
He was using the parable of the Good Samaritan to justify bombing Syria.
With a constant stream of superhero films of late, it's hard not to read into why we as a culture find these stories so interesting. Now, Natasha Moore is with me. Natasha, cultural analysis of superhero movies. What have you got?
I haven't, you know, seen very many of them, like one or two. But hey, that's no reason why I wouldn't have an opinion on this,
no,
right?
Just have a crack anyway.
I have enjoyed some of the ones I've seen, but I wonder about what it says about us as a culture that we're so obsessed with these stories. And the thing that I kind of read into it, maybe a real fan would kind of correct me on whether this is the impulse behind it, but I feel like in a political climate where we already struggle with compromise and working our way slowly through complicated problems, superhero movies really tap into that sense that we just want someone who is like stronger than all of it and transcends it. And we don't have to deal with kind of the complexity. We just want someone to fix it.
Sort it out for us.
Well, yeah.
Definitely has a bit of that vibe. Now, Michael Ramsden, who you spoke with last week about some of the more hair-raising speaking experiences that he's had, and also about whether our culture is a bit commitment-phobic, well, he sees a different trend in the recent rash of superhero films. And he looks at how their backstories have changed and that these days even superheroes need to have a traumatic past. They need to be flawed and suffering, or we can't respect them.
Superman, how can I ever thank you?
Don't try now. You'll be seeing me again. Up, up, and away!
God, look up there!
What the hell is that?
Easy, miss. I've got you.
You've got me? Who's got you?
This is how you came into our world, son. It was the day of the meteor shower.
This is a joke, right?
Why didn't you tell me about this before?
We wanted to protect you.
Protect me from what? You should have told me.
That's a bit of old and new Superman showing some of this evolution from the perfect hero to something a lot darker. I mean, I think this has its limits. You know, Batman, for example, was always pretty dark from the little that I know about.
He was a conflicted character.
There's always been some angst, but it would be interesting to trace that evolution through, I think. Michael argues that this kind of storytelling is a reflection of what he calls the victim culture that we're living in, which is a term that raises some hackles, of course.
Yeah, it does. It sounds a bit like that kind of, you're all a bunch of snowflakes, you millennials, you've got to toughen up.
Yeah, and I was worried maybe that that was where he was going with it, and it's not at all, actually. We were talking about disagreeing well, that old chestnut.
Your favourite topic. Mm-hmm.
And we ended up at justice and bitterness and forgiveness and all kinds of things. He says that the meaning of victim culture in history and in psychology is something different from and just way more interesting than the whole snowflakes political correctness fight that we keep having as a culture. Before we jump into this conversation with Michael Ramsden, quick content warning. Towards the end of the episode in particular, we discuss some topics that could be distressing and are probably not appropriate for children. Okay, here's Michael.
You know, this is something I've talked about a fair amount over the last 18 months or so, and it is very, very, very complicated right now in that we live in what some sociologists term a victim culture. I struggle with that term because of what it conjures up in people's minds. The only reason we've ended up with that term in modern parlance at the moment is historically, in the fields of psychology and so on, we talked about victim culture to mean if one country, say, invades and brutalizes another country and victimizes them. Why is it that then if the tables are turned and that country that once was at the mercy of the other gains the ascendancy, they'll inflict pain back and be blind to it? Does that make sense? So you've got an injustice. A does injustice to B. B suffers the injustice, but now they get the upper hand. And as soon as they get the upper hand, they inflict the injustice back on A. And if you go to them and say, hey, how can you do to them what they were doing to you and say it was morally wrong? And they're like, oh, yes, but it's excused by it. Does that make sense? And so it describes something of that mentality. Well, where we are now socially is we now seem to be in this, sadly, trapped in this very similar position.
The victim will victimize.
Well, that what we've done is we've... So the other thing, piece that we're missing right now is historically, almost all cultures have understand we should never think of ourselves as victims. So historically, why would you counsel a rape victim to say, I'm not a victim? Well, it's not to deny the fact, that's not helpful or true. It's not to deny the feeling, hey, you shouldn't feel this way, that's not helpful or true. What you're saying is, this doesn't define you. This terrible injustice that befell you doesn't define who you are, doesn't give you a source of identity. And it shouldn't dictate your future too. And if you allow what this person did to you, this terrible thing this person did to you, to define who you are and determine your future, they haven't just stolen from you in the past. They're taking from you in the present and they're even stealing your future. And so, hence why they get coached. I am not a victim. I am not a victim. This doesn't define me. And when we met people who couldn't move beyond that, we agreed, yes, this terrible thing's befallen you, but we also thought, how do I help you? I need to help you move beyond this, even if I have to put you on a parallel track so you live with the shadow of it for the rest of your life. The desire of compassion is, this shouldn't define who you are. However, we now live in a culture that questions that. So all of our superheroes are victims. They don't move beyond their victimhood, they are. So the classical film Superman, the original Superman had no faults. Then 2017 Superman is lost on a boat in the sea of fog, struggling with who he is. He feels cosmically abandoned, cosmically lonely. He feels hurt. He can't deal with the weight of expectation. I mean, how can he possibly live in this world? He's a victim to be a superhero today. Every Marvel movie that we see, every Marvel superhero has been used, abused, betrayed, hurt, abandoned. They're all victims.
Is it not that we want a more morally complex
superhero? It can be, but what we do is our superheroes of the past were people who overcame that. The people we really admired were, wow, this country invaded your country and you don't hate them and you don't feel bitter about it. How is that? And we were inspired by it. Does that make sense? You know, or this person attacked you and did this to you and you don't feel embittered by it and you don't, how's that? And those were our heroes. Does that make sense? They were heroes, not in the sense that they were morally perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but somehow these massive historical injustices didn't define them and didn't embitter them. And we wanted to know, wow, how is that possible? I want to be like that. Whereas now what we tend to hold up to people isn't that. We do hold up, now this is the model and everybody wants to be like that. So if we don't have that narrative, we want to invent it. And we've seen some crazy cases in the last 12 months where people have made up terrible things that aren't actually true about them in order to, does that make sense? Hey, I want
like
victim status.
Like their own cancers.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. Because they want that status that comes with being a victim. So, and that's one of the really big changes that's happened. Instead of saying, wow, this can happen to you and it does happen and it's a terrible thing when it happens and how can we help you out of it? Make sense?
Yeah.
Now it's the end goal and it's what people are aspiring to. But the trouble is that what that means then is that all of our cry for justice becomes bitter. And we live in a world now where most justice cries are motivated by anger. And there's a real challenge with that.
But there's reason to be angry.
Yes. Okay.
Injustice.
So, and this is the whole thing. And I think this is where the victim mentality thing doesn't conjure up the right image today, because the way that was used historically was the Germans invade Israel, set up the concentration camps, and they kill 6 million people. How come the Jews don't hate Germans today? That was the original, Where's the victimhood mentality? And why is it sometimes there is a victimhood mentality? And how is it possible for a nation, to make sense, that suffered that at the hands of another nation to forgive it? Does that make sense? So that's where these studies started. Now, but now we use it in a very psychological term. So we assume now when we use the word victim mentality, some minor thing happened, you've blown it out of proportion. Does make sense? And that can happen, sure. I mean, that happens all the time. But that's not what we're talking about. What do you do when you've suffered huge, massive, chronic injustice? How do you respond? There's a very interesting phrase in the Old Testament where it says, you've turned justice into bitterness. And then in a more poetical translation, it says, you've turned justice into bitterness, so your righteous acts taste like poison fruit. In other words, what it's saying is, if your motivation for justice is bitterness, even if you get that which is right, it can taste like poison to everybody else. So if our motivation for justice in this world is because we're bitter and angry, even when we get justice, we're left with bitterness and anger. And even Hollywood knows that. So if you watch all the classic Hollywood films about revenge, and someone kills one or a group of people who did a terrible thing, and at the end they ask the question, you know, so how do you feel now? They'll give a version of, it's not enough. I thought once I killed them all and eliminated them all, I'll feel good now. But so even Hollywood used to know, does that make sense? That can't be the driving. But if what drives our quest for justice in this world is love and compassion, when you get justice, you're left with love and compassion. And so we now think it's a good idea. Of course, we should be really angry and outraged, and we should express that, and that's what should drive this. And if you don't feel that way, then clearly you don't care. Whereas historically, regardless of what culture you were raised in, that was seen to be suspect and dangerous, and certainly incompatible with a Christian world of the world view as well. Whereas now we actually think that's almost the litmus test. Are you angry about the things I'm angry about? And are you as bitter about them as I'm bitter? And then if you are, then clearly you're on the side of justice. And the person who says we need to fight for justice but without the anger or bitterness is seen as a sellout.
You're listening to part two of Natasha's interview with Michael Ramsden, who's a speaker and thinker and one of the founders of the Oxford Center for Christian Apologetics. Today, we're talking injustice and victimhood, bitterness and healing.
One of the important elements to this is the kind of stories that we tell ourselves, both personally and as a culture, about who we are and what's been done to us and how those two things relate to each other.
Yeah, well, we've talked about superhero narratives earlier, but this is visible everywhere we look. And one of the clearest, and I have to say one of the weirdest, accounts of this is one I read in a book called Empire of Illusion. It's a great book. It's about our celebrity culture and illiteracy and spectacle and images and how basically everything is falling apart. It's one of the gloomiest books I've ever read, actually. So the writer, Chris Hedges, picks up on a really interesting example. He's looking at WWE, which you may or may not know, Natasha, is the World Wrestling Entertainment. You know,
I've seen that sort of flicking around.
Yeah, it's there. And he was looking at this as a way of tracking how our cultural stories have changed. Now, I was really interested in this for a couple of reasons. One was, at the time I was reading the book, my son, who I reckon was about 11 then, he was right into WWE. I don't know where it came from, and I was kind of appalled.
It's so bizarre to me. I do not see the appeal.
It's very strange. People go in tens of thousands to watch this. Well, it's truly a pantomime performance. It's really quite something. But what I have to acknowledge is that when I was my son's age, I was right into this stuff too. I loved it. It was fantastic.
I don't understand.
And as Hedges said, and this is very noticeable, The stories that surrounded these wrestling matches when I was a kid were all Cold War stories. So you'd have characters like Boris Brezhnikov, you can imagine, who used to come out with the Soviet anthem playing. He'd be in the Soviet flag, and sometimes he'd be teamed up with people like the Iron Sheikh from Iran, and they would fight
so
against
inappropriate.
The GI, you know, Sergeant Slaughter, this fabulous all-American hero. And it was all terribly racist. But also very notable was you had very clear lines between who was good and who was bad. It was all about the goodies and the baddies. And, of course, America winning.
There he comes. The Iron Sheik right over the top of us and into the ring. Trying to attack
sergeant, but the Sarge beat him to the shot.
Don't you think Sergeant Slaughter was ready for that?
Look at this. He's going to work on the shroud now and ripping it to pieces and throwing it to the crowd. Referee Dick Kroll has already called for the bell, so this match is officially underway.
And look at this. Sergeant Slaughter kicking the sheep on the head with those combat boots. Everyone is on their feet. No one has sat down yet.
Fast forward a few decades, and the WWE storylines have changed hugely. They're now about financial crisis and unemployment. They're about family breakdown and personal revenge. People can be good one week and horribly bad the next. And these are stories that reflect the painful realities of the everyday lives of the audience. Now, Hedges says the new WWE is representative of the cult of victimhood.
I had some follow-up questions for Michael Ramsden about this victimhood stuff and why it matters what stories we're telling ourselves, whether that's in wrestling or otherwise in culture. He talks about how being a victim now confers status and whether we choose to make the injustices that we've suffered core to our identity. He gave that example earlier of Jewish people not hating Germans, not making the Holocaust central to their identity. But I wanted to know, is he suggesting that we should minimize or just kind of get over these real wrongs that have been done? I mean, in a lot of ways, the Holocaust has been incorporated in quite a profound way into the identity of a lot of Jewish communities. And surely I would say that that's appropriate.
The whole thing about this is not about trying to deny something. There's a concept which might be helpful here. Is in some circles it's called chosen trauma, which sounds really weird. How do you choose your trauma? And what it means by that is, if an individual or a nation suffers a massive injustice, does it incorporate it into its core identity or not? Now, post the Second World War, there was a very strong movement amongst Jewish to say this doesn't define us. That makes sense. We're not going to spend, you know. And you just look at what's happened since then. In one sense, it's really remarkable. It's not that it's been forgotten, that makes sense. It's just that the response to it, in many ways, is remarkable. And chosen traumas are things, therefore, which we take present injustices or historical injustices and we incorporate them into our core identity. And that's what we carry. One of the most arresting examples of that is way back in the 1400s, there was a series of battles around Kosovo, and one of the princes from Kosovo was killed in a battle, and the people wanted their hero back, and they were denied the body. And this became part of their folklore. They sang about it. They told stories about it. It was passed on from generation to generation. And when 500 years later, the Austro-Hungarian Empire was now in control of that part of the world. The rulers from Kosovo then made the application. Can we have the body, well, the bones returned to us? We want to bury them here. And the answer was no. And so in order to avenge this historical injustice, 500 years of this felt injustice, on the anniversary of their prince's death, they sent out an assassin and assassinated Archduke Franz Ferdinand and started the First World War. To the day. At the 600th anniversary of that same event was coming up, a guy called Slobodan Milosevic came to power. He promised the people if it was the last thing he ever did, he would have the bones returned and he would be buried in Kosovo. He toured the bones, the empty in the casket, around the country, saying we will never allow this injustice to befall us again. And to the day, on the 600th anniversary of this injustice is when their genocide began, to the day. So this is the whole thing, the danger, if you like, about what are called these chosen traumas. Is, look, there's no denying, does that make sense? Some communities around the world, people around the world have suffered injustice. As a matter of fact, if you want to make it really complicated, nation states are a relatively new idea. You know, you go back far enough in history, you had city-states by and large. Does that make sense? That's what we were. So most countries you see, you can go back 200 years, 500 years, 1,000 years, you keep rolling back the clock, you're going to find a whole bunch of tribes who, through intermarriage and conquest and various other things, eventually formulated into a group of people. So those historical injustices go back thousands of years. I mean, you asked earlier where I was from, and my mother's from Cyprus. I mean, our country's been under foreign occupation by the Persians, the Medes, the Babylonians, the Egyptians, the Assyrians. I mean, you name it. It's been part, you know, Mark Antony gave it as a love gift to Cleopatra. I mean, it's one thing to give a woman flowers and a diamond, another thing to give her a country. I mean, he handed over a whole nation. Here, I love you. Here, to have this country and these people. And sadly, with what happened in 1974 when the Turkish army came in, you know, it's the last divided capital city in the world. Yeah, so Greek Cypriots are great at competitive victimhood because someone says, hey, my people were enslaved 500 years ago and that explains us today. And their response is, ah, we've got thousands of years. We can go back 3,500 years. But it's not healthy. And it doesn't actually really help either. And the question is, how should I feel about Turkish people since I'm from the south? Should I hate them, therefore? I mean, they're sitting on land that used to belong to my family and they've even built hotels on it. So it may be hard at times. Does that make sense? Internally. So the question is, for me, yes, I'd love to see justice happen there and the right thing to be done, but should it be driven by hatred? And should I hate the later generations? Or am I going to reach out in love and compassion? And this is the whole thing. People would say, yes, but if you reach out in love and compassion, that means that you excuse it. And the answer is no. These are people, and I value them, and they have to be treated in a certain way, even if I disagree with them, and even if I want to see some kind of justice come about. But there's no point, that makes sense, me bringing bitterness into this. But it's a very powerful motivator, because if I make lots of people feel embittered, maybe I can start a war. But so I think that's now the world we're living in. What's happened is there's been this radical re-understanding of what beautiful justice looks like, which is why in the past we lauded Nelson Mandela and thought, wow, what a hero. And now some people today would say, no, he failed. He should have capitalized on the bitterness and brought around bloodshed. That would be a better outcome. And so that's a sad thing.
Well, this is my other question. And actually, because I go into school sometimes and speak about freedom of speech and disagreeing well and forgiveness and this sort of thing. And students ask me, they say, but is what you're saying that the victims are the people who have to do something? Wow. It's a double, you know, the onus is on them. This isn't fair.
And here's two very interesting things. I think there are two different things here. I think there is a particular Christian challenge here, which is why when the church fails at this, it's really sad. Jesus, there are a couple of things that Jesus said that even if you're not a Christian, no matter where you live in the world, you've probably heard. And one of them is the Lord's Prayer. And it's very easy to recite without missing the challenge. And forgive us our sins as we forgive those who sin against us. So the question is, how has God forgiven me, and therefore how should I forgive other people? And the message of the gospel isn't, because I made amends with God and figured out that I'd done something wrong and came to him and said, hey, will you forgive me? He went, yeah, okay, you're forgiven. I can see how sorry you are. The message of the gospel is, while I was still his enemy, he came into this world, he paid the price to offer me forgiveness, even before I thought of asking for it. And that's challenging. And sometimes I have to work on it. That makes sense. I experience some things in life and I think, oh, crumbs. How am I going to overcome this one? And it's really, really hard. But the key thing is I don't feel justified in the bitterness and I can't feel justified in it. So I think there's a particularly strong challenge to the Christian in this, more so than everyone else. Does that make sense? If we're the most forgiven people in the world, we need to learn to be the most forgiving. But on the flip side, in terms of just general society, The problem is when we hold on to our bitterness, we end up paying twice for all of the injustice we've suffered. I say we pay once when it happened, and then we pay again on every remembrance of it. And I remember once speaking in a university, and a lady was there every night, sitting in the same row on the front row. And so after a few nights, I began to, you know, just recognize her. And every night, I would say, if you want to come and talk to me, please do. I'll be here to ask questions and so on. And every night I thought, it looked like to me she was wrestling with coming up, you know, or not. And on the last night, I can remember thinking, if she's still there, I'm going to go talk to her. And sure enough, she was there early, sat in the same seat on the front row, left hand side, right by the aisle. And after I finished speaking, after I spoke with a few people, I went and sat next to her and I said, I hope you don't mind. I said, I've noticed you here every evening. I said, and every evening when I've talked about forgiveness and also receiving forgiveness from God, it's almost felt like you've wanted to say yes, but nothing's happened. And I'm just wondering, is there something you'd like to talk to me about? And she said, I've been trying to stand up on the inside. I said, do you mind if I ask what you feel is your struggle? And she said, I was sexually abused by my grandfather. So if I ask God to forgive me, do I have to forgive him? And I remember saying to her, can I ask what your counselor is telling you at this point? And she said, oh, well, my counselor is saying I should hold on to my anger and express my rage. So I said, well, is that helping you right now? And she said, no, it's getting worse. She said, I'm now 23 years old, and I feel like first time I told someone was 3 years ago, and I feel like it's getting worse and worse every week. And I said, I just said to her what I said now, I think you're paying twice. You paid every time he did this to you, and now every time you remember, you're paying again. When you let go of the inside bitterness and release that, that's not to say that therefore the grandfather should be let out of prison and have no consequence. That's different. There are two different aspects to this. There's the internal ability to actually let go of all of that pain and that anger and that bitterness and that hatred, which is actually killing us. And then there's the question about externally, what happens? And justice still has to be upheld, otherwise there's no hope, because when justice collapses in a society, hope does collapse with it. So there should be an ongoing price. It's just that, in my sense, it's not out of a sense of, now I want to make you suffer. That's not the motivation for them being in prison. And in some cases, the nature of the betrayal of the relationship is such that it could never be fully restored. But again, the key thing is it's no longer defining the victim anymore. And that's the key bit for people to understand. Otherwise, what we're doing is we're storing up a lot of trouble for ourselves. Because it's very difficult to live with all of that in a healthy way. It can't be done.
This has been part two of Natasha's interview with Michael Ramsden. If you missed part one, why not go back and listen? In that conversation, you learn a lot about his personal story, like the time he found himself in the middle of an Australian leadership challenge between Prime Ministers Tony Abbott and Malcolm Turnbull.
As always, we'd love you to subscribe to Life and Faith, leave us a rating or review, and let people know if you liked this episode and you think they would as well. Next week.
When I was in the mission, we weren't allowed to speak our language, but the missionaries, I thought they were pretty smart. They taught us choruses in language. But I put one together with Pidginjarra, wasn't it?
Mm.
I heard these Māori people singing, and I said, can I put Aboriginal words to that? And they said, go ahead and do it. And this is it. We're going to sing it for you. You started us now.